still, to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Hello, Zero Books readers and viewers. Welcome to another live stream. We've been doing quite a lot of them lately. Today, I'm here with Leo Cookman. Leo is a writer and a musician based in Kent, and he is currently a writer of scripts for the YouTube channel Wisecrack, which I know a little bit about. I've written a couple scripts for them in the past. He's also written for the Hong Kong Review of Books, Philosophy Now magazine, and he's written features on philosophy and theory for several other publications, including Zero Books. His book, Time's Lie, is out today from Zero. So, Leo, welcome to the Zero Books YouTube channel live stream.
Hello. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm glad to talk to you. I'm glad to talk to you about your book called Time's Lie, because it seems as though both in the UK and the United States, we're in a particular historical moment where getting something like the truth from the media would be nice. And your book is, amongst other things, about the prevalence of fake news and the difficulty that we have getting something like the truth. But I guess I should start just by asking, how did you come to write this book, Time's Lie, and how is this book different from other books on ideology, fake news, manufacturing consent, and the rest?
So it's, the reason I was prompted to write it was I write poetry and fiction and narrative-ish stuff, less just pure theory a lot of the time, and that's what I used to write. And so I read an awful lot of books on narrative itself, but in reference to like films and screenplays and literature and things like that. And I noticed a trend quite a while ago now. It would have been sort of, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago, but the word narrative kept cropping up a bit more and more, and it sort of reached a real peak in the last 10 years, where it was more to do with the way like news reporters mention narrative, or people mentioned narrative not in reference to fiction or mass media or like films, books, television, video games, things like that. People were talking about narratives within life, and it seemed a bit one of those things like using the word content or consumer, or it was that sort of an objective term that didn't really feel necessary when people had always just called them news stories or whatever. Mm-hmm. These are now narratives, and that kind of annoyed me, and I didn't actually like the way it was being used. But the more it got used, and then particularly when over the last 10 years, when a lot of what's, as you say, the post-truth society has arrived, there was an awful lot of talk about narratives emerging and how narratives sort of just grow like weeds almost. And that is not what, that isn't how they work. And so this prompted me to go, all right, so if we're going to be using this word narrative, we need to know, and applying it to real life, we need to know what that means, and we need to define that better. And so we understand it better when people say like this, Trump's new narrative, or the Brexit narrative, or the coronavirus narrative. And so after doing a bit of reading on it, and I already knew plenty about narrative itself, but more theoretical stuff, it was, it became more and more prevalent about how it interacts with ideology, or it's basically an expression of ideology almost. It's like you create your narrative via your ideology, and that was really what prompted it, because I was just getting sick of people using the word. But if it's going to be this new way of defining things, so that's why I call it narrativization, is it's because it's creating a narrative, it's you're verbing it essentially. So that hence that's the title, and essentially that's what prompted the whole desire to write the book.
Yeah, you know, the first time I heard the term narrative being used in a political media context was probably either the 2000 election or the 2004 election in the United States. So a certain narrative took hold around Al Gore that we were told after the fact that was the decisive in his loss. It was a narrative of his flip-flopping, the narrative of his indecision and his character. Basically his phoniness as well. And then in 2004, a narrative, very similar narrative, actually, I think maybe the flip-flop charge was with John Kerry even more than Al Gore, took hold, but this time it was very intentionally done through a Swift Boat campaign, and the Swift Boat people were the people who had served with him on a Swift Boat during the war in Vietnam, and they were questioning his Purple Hearts. They came forward and said, yeah, he wasn't much of a soldier. So there was a story that then set up a narrative. But why don't you, what do you think the difference is between a story that we hear or that makes the rounds and a narrative?
So the way I define it in the book is the story is the object. So the story is the object that you are handing over, as it were. So the idea or the ideology that you have is this, is a sort of the story, encapsulates by the story. The narrative is the process by which that story is told, and the events and the connective tissue of that story. So the story is the object, and the narrative is the engine, as it were, that drives those narratives. So that drives the story. So you present the story as the object using narrative.
Can you give me an example of a story that drives a narrative? Did the one I give, would that work?
Yeah. Well, the one I remember, an early one I remember, was Columbine, weirdly, and has been used on school shootings since, was when they first started using narrative. And a lot of those, and bear in mind, when I talk about narrative, as I explained in the book, there isn't just one, generally, as we all know. There will be lots and lots of different narratives around a certain topic, and it tends to be the ones that the media picks up on that tend to float to the top, as it were. But so, for instance, the big ones on Columbine were the god-awful, I mean, truly despicable ones by InfoWars and things like that. So you have a narrative there. So their story, the object that they're trying to present is that this is fake. This is not, these shootings aren't real, and these people were actors or whatever. So the idea behind it, the story, is that these are fake, that this isn't real, and for various bias reasons. So the narrative is how you construct that. And the way I talk about it in the book is you use consistency and consensus are the two ways narrative are built best. So you get a consensus, so you get other people to generally agree by presenting the story to them and telling them the narrative, and then you derive a consensus from those you present it to, and the way you present it to them should have consistency. So in that regard, it was all the things about actors. I can't even remember what, because it was such nonsense and crap. It was just like, it was things like, you know, the kids were actors, and it was all staged, and it was paid for by Clinton or something, I don't know. But so there's all these are the consistency that he was trying to drive, and he kept repeating these certain things like false flag and things like that. And that's, and then you build the events like where they were and who they worked with, and you know, these people were hired, but so this is all the consistency that he's trying to build, or they are trying to build. And then the consensus is when you present that narrative and you go, and people will go, that sounds about right, I remember this happening also. And that applies to even now with the current coronavirus crisis. So things like just the nurses even, or the way, or the gun-toting people outside town halls who are demanding to be going back to work. The narrative there is that this is all...
I haven't heard that they were carrying guns, but
well, there was. I just remember that there's a vivid shot of a guy with an AR-15 outside on the steps of somewhere with his flak jacket on and things. And so the narrative they are pushing is that, you know, this isn't, you know, this is freedom, this is America. So, and that has a very quick consensus. You know, we're a free country. We demand, you know, the right to be free to get ourselves sick. I don't really know what, again.
Yeah. The way you're describing story and narrative is maybe an inversion of how I usually think about it, but that's fine. But the way I usually think about it is like in the 2016 election, there was a narrative around Hillary Clinton that she was corrupt and duplicitous and not to be trusted. That was the overall narrative frame. And then the stories that would be fit into that might be about her emails, or about her hiding her health issues, or a variety of other things, right? And then there'll be like these moments which are little stories which confirm the overall narrative, like when she fainted at a 9/11 memorial. But it seems like what you're saying is that the story is, but the way you're using the word story is more like how I would use the word narrative. And the narrative is... I'm not sure if it's the same as how I'm using the word story here or not.
The way I'm sort of trying to is it's these are all layers essentially. So the stories of Hillary Clinton fainting, say, that was one of the stories that was she was weak because she fainted. And that's the story, as it were. And that fits into the narrative of she's unfit to lead, which. And these are all parts of that narrative, which creates another overarching story of she shouldn't be president.
Do we need to start introducing other terms like theme? Is there a theme to the Hill? There's the opposition's theme that they apply to the Hillary Clinton campaign. And the theme is a theme of corruption. And then there are all these narratives that they use to justify this theme that they're trying to bring home. Would that be a good way to think of it?
Yeah, I mentioned this in the book because there's like, if you look books on screenplay or literature or things like that and how they tell stories, how they tell their narratives, that a lot of that is about, you talk about foreshadowing and theme and things like technical terms that work within literature and these kinds of fiction processes. And the thing is, it's very hard if you say, like, if you talk about your own life, it's like, what's the theme of my life? But actually, if most people ask, if you were asked anyone, people would be able to say that, oh god, my theme of my life is failure, or, you know, the theme of my life is, you know, this, that. So you inherently create the point I'm trying to make in the book is that this is a natural process of human beings, that this is why it's called Time's Lie, is that it's about perception. It's how we perceive things, including time. And so we always see things beginning, middle, and end. We see things from a start to middle and to the end. And ironically, it's only once things tend to have concluded that you actually have perspective enough to tell the story. But as I point out again in the book, is that what we're experiencing now in the age of, and I think this is why it's become more of a popular term, is we're telling stories before the story's finished. So I think that's why narrative comes up more, because you're talking about the individual events, so the different disparate events that need to be connected. There is no conclusion necessarily yet, and you try to impress a theme upon them and things like that. So the reason narrative I feel works the way I'm explaining it works quite well for the way people in the, say, the news, or if you're talking about these stories, works quite well actually, is because you don't have enough distance. You don't have the appropriate distance to say what the theme is or what the story is even yet. You just have to tell the narrative, and you and your the story you have, i.e. your ideology, would be, you know, why Hillary Clinton is sick and weak and shouldn't be president. And so you build the narrative to tell this story.
Are all of the narratives necessarily false?
No. There's and this is the point, is like this is why I say story is the object, is you're not, the story is actually quite, is inert almost. It's the way the narrative, ironically, and I say this in the book, is that the narrative, ironically, is if you, even though the story is the object, you actually describe stories in subjective terms. So you say a love story or a sad story, or whereas a narrative would always be described in objective terms. You wouldn't say a love narrative or a sweet narrative. You'd say things like it was a strong narrative, or it was a revealing narrative or something. But what you end up with is a story actually can be anything, because essentially it is objective, but it's how you present it, and the way you present it via your ideology essentially is. And that's the thing, is people will look at narrative as objective because you're just relating the facts. So when you say a narrative, that's just the facts. You can't argue with, these are what the events were. But as we all know, that's not true. We build narratives ourselves. And this is what I was trying to dissuade, is when people say narratives emerge as if they're natural weeds. They're not.
When I was, I'm a novelist as well as a publisher. So when I was starting out writing, one of the earliest, I went to a writer's workshop in Seattle way back in the 90s. And I remember one of the teachers, the guy who wrote the book, Egypt. I forgot his name all of a sudden, but anyhow, he made a big point about the way you write a story is not the way most people think about writing a story, especially if they've gotten most of their stories from television or movies. The way to write a story is to think of the voice of the story.
Yes. Yeah.
Which is another way of saying who is your main character, but it's a little more abstract than that, because you don't have to write every story from a first person perspective. You don't have to be clear about who is telling the story, but in every story there is a voice, even ones that try to pass themselves off as third person, transparent stories. So it sounds to me like the story is what has a voice. Is that true?
Yeah, I would say so. And that's the very nature of how we what we are. And the reason it's called Time's Lie is because we, and I go into this in the book, is that there's a discrepancy about what time is, how it works. I mean, generally speaking, time's not really a real thing, hence time's lie, because it's basically how we perceive stuff working in the universe. And that works really well on Earth, because there's we can see, if you throw something it breaks. If we time passes, we can watch a clock move, we break eggs, we make omelets, this makes sense. Whereas if you actually extrapolate beyond things, then actually, or if you zoom really close in, that's not quite how things work. But the way we perceive things is very dependent on narrative. And you only need to see it as far back as, cavemen would do paintings that would just tell some sort of story, whether it's them throwing spears at animals to kill them or just migration or something like that. And so the story is always like the story that a caveman is trying to tell by making these paintings, or that the Odyssey was trying to tell, was always from a perspective. Even if it was trying to be a history, as it were, it's still from the individual's perspective. And why did they select those specific animals? Why did they specifically select this story to tell? And that's the, if you speak to any historian, that's one of the biggest problems, is that how do you filter out what you need to do to tell, and why are you telling this specific story about history? And that works right up until the contemporary moment, right to this second. You can, why are you choosing to tell this story? There's lots of interesting reasons for that.
Yeah. When I was really little, one of the first stories I ever heard was the Three Billy Goats Gruff. You know that story?
Yes. Yeah.
And then I actually got a little book that was the same story, only told from the point of view of
the troll,
right? and he was, you know, making the point that these goats were really abusive to him and that kind of thing. And I could tell that I still sided with the goats, right?
Yeah.
But it did bring to mind the fact that maybe there is another perspective on these narratives or stories, I guess. Mm. And should we think about something like that when we consider a figure like Trump? I mean, the fact that there's a different voice that's talking to different demographics, and that the same facts are fitting into a very different story in each case. Like, for instance, this thing about Trump the other day saying, I think it was yesterday, maybe it was the day before, saying that we should maybe inject disinfectant into people.
and bathe ourselves in sunlight or whatever it was.
Yeah, right.
Yes.
To cure the coronavirus. Is that a story that has... that is objective, truly objective, that is the same for everybody, or is that just going to fit differently into another, you know, to the right wing narrative or the right wing story? Access to that story as something in and of itself as an object?
Yeah, because the thing is, it's funny because if you watch him in real time develop that narrative, which is like in front of the camera, because you see him going, is that what you said? Am I getting this right? You said that this was this and that. And so he's taking the constituent parts of a narrative that may have vaguely been what the guy said, that like there was a way of, you know, you use ventilators, say, to clear the lungs. And like, so he's picked up on the word clear and put something in your lungs. And so he's taken these constituent parts and reassign them to narrative. And what's interesting is he's making appeal to some sort of consensus. So he's saying, is this right? This is what you said. Like, this is what I'm going to fit this together as a story. And in real time, he's presenting this story. And I think it's a very important thing that when people talk about the post-truth society, I mean, the examples I use in the introduction are, I can't remember her name, Dolezal.
I was going to ask you about why you chose to talk about her, but continue on with Trump for a moment longer.
Yeah, yeah. But they is when you talk about Trump, is he's still trying to present, he's still trying to gain consensus. He's still trying to get, like, he's always appealing to his base, right? And aren't we all? Like, this is the same with Sanders. This is the same with everyone. There's no, as I say, a narrative is just a process by which we view things. But, and so Trump's own narrative in his head that he has, or his own story that he constantly adds the narrative to, constantly adds to the narrative of, that he's a great president, that he's hard done by, that, you know, all these sorts of things. And so to re-narrativize almost, you can see him changing this in real time. And it is, the thing is, there's not, this is why I mentioned again in the book, is that there's, when people talk about how facts can, like, what was it thing he said, alternative facts, you know, it's that the thing is, there's always a fact can prove anything almost, and people will manipulate facts in a variety of ways. And so a fact is a fact, as it were, you know, a scientific fact. And we've really felt this here in the UK with the appalling way our government has dealt with it, but because they said they were following the science, and that was what they said. They've been really, you know, they were solidly following the science to begin with. only for that science to then change. And they probably were following. I mean, you get the impression they probably were, but it was depending which experts they spoke to. And the trouble is that makes, so they needed to create a narrative that, well, in our case, kept shops open, you know, kept the economy running and things like that. So their science played very heavily into that narrative. And so to keep the story going, as it were.
Yeah. You know who you hear about a lot these days, or the country you hear about a lot these days is Sweden. Because there's a need to create a story about opening up the economy again, getting people back to work, ending the lockdown. And and Sweden used the herd immunity science, those facts, to justify not really doing a lockdown or not doing nearly as much of one. I don't know what the outcome is going to be in Sweden, but I think that it's worse than it is here.
Yeah,
in deaths per million already.
Yeah, ratio wise, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And that's so, kind of what that I feel that's what was they were going for here. And like, we officially have the worst death rate in Europe. It was originally Italy and Spain had the worst, and then we passed them.
Are you sure? Is that per capita?
It was. I think. I don't. I'm not too sure. I just remember there was a big hoo-ha about
this. The facts. Yeah. So it depends on what story you want to tell, right?
Exactly. And that's the thing is, like, there was an awful lot on, particularly on the left, obviously, here in the UK, that was like, this is an utter failure, because Italy and Spain had very, very high mortality rates. And we were looking at Italy, and they had a good couple of weeks on us, like when the virus arrived and stuff. And when they went into lockdown and when the deaths started soaring, we were like, oh my God, look at Italy. Look what's happening in Italy. This is awful.
And here's a list of the worst cases.
Oh, okay.
Deaths per million.
Okay.
San Marino.
Oh, wow.
Belgium. I mean, San Marino doesn't really count. Belgium, Andorra, Spain, Italy, France, the UK. And then the Netherlands, Sweden, Isle of Man, Ireland, the Channel Islands, Switzerland, then the USA.
Yeah. And that's the thing is, like you say, it's the, depending who you want to talk to here about who has the worst deaths in Europe, it all benefits your narrative. If you want to say the UK's got the worst deaths in Europe and goddamn the bloody Tories, then that's very convenient for the left narrative to take those, because that's the thing. I was presented with these graphs and things, and we were definitely above Spain and Italy, say.
Well, if you're talking about like the rate of growth or new cases, then the UK is worse.
New cases then, right.
Right. The new deaths today, they're worse than any of these countries that I mentioned that were above them, because it's like 768 new deaths today.
Right.
So if you're looking into the future, they may very well be, the UK may have a worse outcome. But at the moment, it's Spain has 482 deaths per 1 million. Italy has 430 deaths per 1 million. It's very difficult to say.
Yeah. And this is precisely the point, is because we're in the middle of it. And so there's these, and this is the thing, is we're trying to narrativize it. So here, you know, the left is saying, this is awful, we've been failed, because look at the way that this has been treated and how many people are dying and all sorts of other horrible things that are going wrong. But equally, the right wing are saying, we're doing the absolute best we can, and this is a tragedy. But look, the curve is flattening. It is slowly going down. We are, you know, this is, the trend is up, but, you know, this is a very hard thing, and we've had to, you know, milk the coffers, and this isn't the time for blame, and we're all working very hard.
This makes me so frustrated to hear you talk this way, and this is why your book is important, I think, is because the other day on Facebook, I put down that the left's anti-American ideology is making it more difficult for them to deal with reality. And of course that just set off a firestorm on my Facebook page. But I didn't mean to say that America was the greatest or, you know, nothing was wrong here. I just meant like, you know, before you start to look at the facts, don't have your conclusions already formed.
Exactly.
You know, and and it also doesn't mean that just because the United States is not the worst, doesn't have the worst outbreak in the world, doesn't mean that it has handled things well either.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so the question becomes like, okay, in the UK, did Boris Johnson make a terrible mistake for a few weeks talking about the herd immunity approach and not locking down when he should have? And yes, absolutely. And obviously, and shaking people's hands. Absolutely. But then the other question is, okay, how successful has the lockdown actually been? And if it has been successful at all, if it's true that the right wing's right, that there is a flattening of the curve, what does that tell us about what we need to do next?
Mm.
Right.
Yeah.
And what people on my timeline tend to want to do is say, oh, the virus is no worse than the flu. It's being hyped up. It's some sort of conspiracy. Even people who are supposedly on the left will say kind of stuff like this at times. And then, or they'll say, well, we have to put put health first, and we can't let the economy dictate everything to us. And mm-hmm. I was like saying, well, actually, here's the terrible news, folks. The virus is real. And it's sending us into a depression.
Yeah.
Right.
Lockdown or not, that's going to happen.
Right. So what do we do with this information rather than trying to create a fantasy version of reality that makes it so we're in the right from the start and we don't have to change what we're doing, you know? But anyway, I'll let you talk a little bit. I'm ranting.
I completely agree. It's that, and that's the trouble, is that we are in the middle of the story. And I think that's what's very important to say. There are lots of smallest, as I say, these are all sort of, it's different levels of where the narrative is. So you can look at the story of people protesting, because that is a story. We've seen what's happened, and that, you know, that we can tell the story and say, well, that's not very sensible, is it, going outside at the moment? Because we do know it's a real virus. And but equally, then we've got, so the facts are that people can't afford things and people are going to struggle. And in the short term, you know, people have had their stipend checks. My wife is American. She's had her check through. And so there is some sort of attempt at these kind of thing. They've just signed for the stimulus bill. The second one, is that right? Mm. Or how much
they
have. Help?
Yeah. There was another stimulus. This is a bailout, really.
Yeah.
And yeah. It's mostly probably going to corporations. There's not enough in it for everyday people. But, you know, it's very difficult to say. The problem is that we have so little time to process things that all we end up doing is embracing different narratives and having sort of knee-jerk reactions, regardless of what our political ideology is, really.
We can't. And this is why people keep saying sort of is not follow the science, because then, and that's the trouble, is people say just follow the important science. It's like, it depends who you're talking to, and it really does, because every country has done it completely differently. But I think the results speak for themselves, and this is what I mean about stories, is like we're still in the middle of the narrative, but we can look at trends. Like if you look at New Zealand and South Korea and places like that, where the number of, like New Zealand, the graph is ridiculous. It went up like very small amount and then tanked, like disappeared, because they immediately instated a lockdown. They did lots of contact tracing. Same with South Korea. It spiked quite badly, but it plummeted when they did the contact tracing.
Yeah, my kid was in South Korea when they first got the outbreak. He was a foreign exchange student. He's back now early, and I feel like he jumped out of the frying pan into the fire in a way, because they were finally sort of seeing everything work in South Korea when everyone got sent home, primarily because of all the travel bans that were going on and the fear that they wouldn't be able to come back. But anyhow, so South Korea did really, really, really well. But the question there is, okay, to what extent can we or do we want to emulate South Korea's success? And what I'm talking about there is the surveillance and the track, you know, the loss of civil liberties that might be involved. I mean, not that we have a lot anyway, and not that there isn't surveillance already, but you know, what, how do we, if we're going to try to do what South Korea did, how would we do it without changing some of the, in the United States, some of the basic protections of privacy and freedom that we have here. But there should, you know, that should be the conversation that we're having rather than, are we going to open up the economy or not? Or is this working? Or is it just the flu? Or is it a Chinese weapon?
Or 5G. 5G giving us
Or is it five? Five people, you know, the real truth is, I want to tell you something right now, all right? The truth is, it's all fake. And the reason they did it was because they had to change the batteries in those birds.
Oh, right. You know,
birds aren't real. And so they had to go out there, and those robotic birds needed to be recharged, or the batteries changed out.
I forgot about that. Yes, of course, the birds aren't real. But and I think that's, it's, and this is, if you want to talk about like the meanings behind things, it's like there's been some really interesting philosophical discussions by your average Joe right now, who's suddenly become experts on social contract theory or the inherent contradictions of capital, or, you know, because suddenly people are confronted with actually what this theory is. Like, if you want to talk about praxis, Jesus Christ, we're suddenly living through, like, my favorite one was all the landlords in, I don't know if it's the same in America, but in UK, the awful groups of landlords who are just going, well, you can't just not pay your bills, because then I can't pay my bills. And it's because this, it's, you see them slowly become self-aware about, like, yes, we can't pay our bills because this is how the economy works. We pay you, because, but if we can't pay you, then you can't pay your, like, the bills come on effect.
Right.
So when these landlords go,
oh, you're not employed, so you can't pay your bills. But if you can't pay your bills, then I can't pay my bills.
Yeah, exactly.
But unlike, but see, the difference between a landlord and a worker is the landlord can get a new worker.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. They can kick these people out and see if they can find someone new to move in who might have a job, work from home. But yeah, it's certainly not a
but this is
moral or ethical thing.
Yeah, and these are these sort of the narratives that are suddenly appearing, is all these are so dependent on a lot of the theory of the way the society works. And I think it's so interesting to that people's perception is being called into question, and how, like, we're really seeing, and I've written the odd thing about this regarding narrative, and it's an interesting thing to discuss about narrative tension. And that's what you do in fiction as well. You create narrative tension by having competing narratives. Essentially, you have like one character's trying to finish their story and another character's trying to, and so if you look at that as competing forces within an economy, or if you look at competing forces within you know, the actual science, like, because there are conflicting ideas about how to operate, what we should do, and I really feel like it's suddenly, like, to toot my own horn, it's suddenly become really important to tell the right story and or tell the right narrative, so that we get our stories straight, as it were, because otherwise, because this is going to be a slow explosion. And I think that's what I think people are sort of pushing to their back of the minds, everyone knows, but this is going to be a long, like, the disease itself isn't going to go away for a year and a half, maybe 2 years. That's, like,
the Imperial College of London said 18 months,
and
that was optimistic.
Yeah, that is optimistic. And there's been the talk of the vaccine and stuff, but a vaccine.
That, I mean, the idea was in 18 months there would be a vaccine or antivirals or both. And that was saying we throw all the usual regulations out, we speed through the process, and we get a vaccine, which is, you know, not at all guaranteed.
That's assuming the first vaccine they try works. So you've got to try different vaccines for a start. Then you've got to make sure that they don't kill people within 6 months.
Well, I heard that sunlight is incredible, and maybe you put that inside our body.
And yes, use hand wash.
Or disinfectant. Have you heard?
Yeah,
you hear about the disinfectant?
what I'm hearing you're saying is we should use bleach. We should drink bleach.
That's right. Well, listen, I want to ask you about Rachel Dolezal and why you chose to include her. What was her story, and how did that illustrate your main point? And then we have some people watching, and maybe we can take some questions from people.
Yes. Well, I use Rachel Dolezal as like the first example, and then actually Elizabeth Warren is the second one. Mm. yeah, ironically, a little less popular at the moment. But
no, I'm not particularly fond of Elizabeth Warren.
No,
if I had a snake emoji I could flash on the screen, I would right now. Anyway, go ahead.
But quite. And so Rachel Dolezal was basically, so if you don't know the story, she was a chair of the NAACP in, I think it was Washington State where she lived. And she also taught African American studies, I believe, at a university. And she identified as black. And there was an interview, a now notorious interview, where she was asked about this, and a journalist had done the research basically and said that you don't, but your parents are white, like you don't actually have any black heritage. And she walked away. She didn't answer the question, and she just walks away. And so then it became this huge furor. She was mercilessly destroyed on social media, and she lost her job. She lost the chair of the NAACP where she was. Mm. Netflix made a documentary about her a few years later. But what that prompted in me, and the reason I brought up Elizabeth Warren as well, a similar thing happened, was the idea of race. And this is, we're getting into choppy waters, and I don't want to pretend I'm an authority and I'm a white guy, so you know, all caveats.
Well, I don't identify as white, so I'm in the clear.
Okay, keep cool. Going.
So I'll be the person color in this conversation. I'll verify everything you say.
Okay.
I'm not going to say what I identify as, because that would get me into trouble.
Quite.
But well, I'll do a DNA test later, and we can.
Yes, exactly. Well, and that was the thing, was so there was when Dolezal was asked why she did it, her response was she self-identifies as black, and she has no demonstrable black heritage within her family. And this was actually research. Someone did a genealogy research on her. I can't remember their name, but I mentioned it in the book. And there is no evidence of any people of color. I think whatsoever, really. It is all British colonists, essentially, very, very white Anglo-Saxon Protestant family that she has. And yet she self-identified as black to the extent that she was a teacher, that she taught African-American studies. She was the chair of the NAACP in her state. She was entrenched in everything we believe as a narrative of race. And this is where we get into the choppy waters about what we talk about. And I don't want to be definitive, because I know it upsets and annoys people, but the race and things like gender and all these sorts of things do essentially contribute to being created. And they do tell a story over time. And a particularly potent one when it comes to African-American people, any people of color in America. And so to have someone who identified as black to such a convincing degree, let's be honest, she was, you know,
yeah, she passed.
Yeah, she definitely passed. So so what does that mean? That calls into question basically what race is at a really fundamental level, because you can say, no, of course she wasn't black, and that's stupid, and she should have.
I don't want to drop this topic, and we'll come back to it, but we did get a couple of super chats, and I want to give people the chance here. So what are your views on thoughts on hypotheticals as arguments through storytelling? Do you think arguments through storytelling is a useful way to do politics?
I personally think they're the best way, in my opinion. I think Socrates, Plato, you know, they knew that very well. You wouldn't have the dialogues, which are essentially dramatizations of conversations about opposing forces, which, you know, Hegel, you have dialectics because of that. You have the thesis, antithesis, and that's essentially storytelling. And that's why Hegel and Marx describe this as, you know, the narrative of history, you know, the march of history being this story that you tell. And I think certainly when it comes to fiction and films and things like that, I think if anyone's tried to read Hegel, Jesus Christ, like that could do with being more fun. I've tried and failed miserably, and it's yeah, I think stories are, and that's the thing.
I have a better story than you around Hegel then, because I've read the Phenomenology and I'm a full on Hegelian after that. I need to read the Science of Logic.
Oh yeah, I completely. Yeah, I'm not saying I disagree with Hegel's theories or anything. It's just the actual writing itself. And
I'm just bragging. That's all. Just keep going. Here's another question. Are the most powerful narratives the ones that allow people to assimilate facts, or the ones that compel people to overlook inconvenient facts?
Well, that is a good question, because the thing is, I think narrative helps you do both. Yeah. Well done, Mike. I think the important thing is that you do, narratives are capable of doing both. So your narrative, and most people do tell a story that will conveniently overlook certain facts. If you've ever talked to someone who's reinvented themselves, as they put it, that's normally re-narrativizing. And you tell, you're retelling your story in a different way. You're moving facts around to, again, that's what Dollazol did. It was sort of rearranging this narrative to more conveniently express what she believed she was, and that's, I think, what's so interesting at the moment is that it's this tension we're finding with reality, subjectivity and objectivity. Is your the narratives of truth are always come with some caveats, because they're still being told by us, which inherently leaves certain things out. So I think it's the intent, and this is why I talk about stories being the object and how you present them. Like, the narrative will always be subjective. We will always tell them different ways, and we will always leave facts out. It's how you present the story, and it's what the story you're telling is behind your ideology or whatever you want to term it. That's really important. And but yeah, I think it can do both. It can both leave out convenient lies of omission and all that, but it can also, the more facts you do put into something, the more solid a narrative becomes.
So I want to go back to this Rachel Dolezal story, because there's a piece of it, I'm not sure if it's, remind me if this is in your book or if you bring it up, but there was, for me, the conclusion of that scandal took place in a feminist philosophy journal.
Oh, right.
Because someone wrote a defense of her,
right,
and of being transracial for, I think, a feminist philosophy journal called Hypothea or something. I forget. Oh. And that became a huge scandal in and of itself.
Huh. Oh, and, I think I did read this, actually. It's really
And they made her, the editorial board retracted the essay and apologized. And and the thing about it was, the author who was writing the piece defending her along those same lines that she would defend someone who was a transgender.
Right. Yeah.
Using the same logic that you would use to defend someone's right to identify as a different gender. Was doing so in good faith. But she was being perceived as either attacking transgender people by making the argument that Rachel Dolezal should be protected, should be made allowances for, and really we should embrace her, or making some sort of racist argument, or I think most people kind of took it up as an attack on both
people, right? Like, okay,
both transgender people and people of color were being attacked by this essay that was philosophically defending Rachel Dolezal and the right to be transracial.
I think the most interesting defense of Rachel Dolezal was by a writer called Mark Ronson, who wrote a book called So You've Been Publicly Shamed.
Mm-hmm.
And he uses her as an example. And it's more to do with... And this is what I find interesting is, and why the documentary is interesting, is because there's merit to her story. And I don't think, I do not mean that she should have identified as black, or, that I disagree with that, and that isn't correct. And this is the thing, is that it's more to do, what Mark Ronson points out, is that her story, as it were, is important, because it actually says more about social media and how she was publicly shamed, when she's clearly, this woman clearly has some forms of issues with identity that she's not reconciled, or there's some issues here that we shouldn't have just immediately attacked the person for, not necessarily because she's I'm not saying she was right to identify this way, but like there's room for the that to not to us not to just mercilessly rip her apart. But
what do you think the right response should have been? Like, she was working for the NAACP somewhat on the basis of her identity, right? Is that true? Or what, yeah. Did they care? Okay. So something probably needed to be said.
Oh, yes.
To her employer. I don't know if she absolutely needed to be fired. It depends on to what degree it was, you know, part of the contract that you really had to be a person of color or black to be part of the NAACP in that position. But if it was the case, then probably she should have been let go. Mm. But I don't know if the need, like I'm with Ronson, if we really needed to drag her through the mud or hold her up for public ridicule. But doing so raised issues, which then I guess we're not really.
Yeah.
I mean, I know I'm not willing to settle any of these issues.
No, exactly. Live stream, quite.
But people aren't really fully prepared to engage. Talk about Elizabeth Warren now. So Elizabeth Warren did the same thing. Mm-hmm. She didn't ever pass. No one ever thought she was actually a Native American in the sense that matters. She was Native American like a lot of white women are. She's part Cherokee, and she's been to a New Age bookstore and, you know, and knows some recipes or stole them. So what do you think, what's the difference between the two stories?
So, well, the reason I use them both in the introduction is actually, I think they say something really important. And this is what, again, it's contentious, but the idea that that race is a narrative and a historical narrative that has gone on since, you know, we invented it because we did. And not that people don't have different color skin or anything, but the amount of melanin you have in your skin should have, like, there isn't really anything to be said about
you can look back at the historical record and see how the concept of race was developed historically, especially around the slave trade.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it's no doubt at all that the concept of race, I mean, the concept of ethnicity or noticing physical differences, that's been around. Or I'm not sure about it, but how it's been conceptualized has changed. And
so, and this is the important thing, is that we have, as a human race, we have agreed upon a narrative of race. And I don't mean we've agreed that all black people should be slaves and, you know, like that's...
Hey, man, that may be what you think, but that's what I think.
How dare you?
As a person of color, as I said earlier, I can't stand this any longer. All right, keep going. Now I'm going to get canceled. So anyway, keep going.
But the idea that that race is a narrative then is we have foundationally agreed upon this idea of that race is important and that we've, and over the years, and again, it's developing, it's a narrative. So it's still ongoing. It's not the story. It is a narrative. And so this element continues to be told about what race is. And it's, and I think what both Elizabeth Warren and Rachel Dolezal both did was called into question what we think of as race, because they were attempting to prove themselves as a race that they were demonstrably not. And that was the thing, is that when Elizabeth Warren did do the DNA test, and apparently there was some evidence of Cherokee heritage.
Like 0.003.
Yeah, exactly.
A little bit more Cherokee heritage than progressive politics.
Quite. So she, but this challenged, and this is why I think there was such a huge blowout on, and why we absolutely, and I think the response should have been, to both Elizabeth Warren and Rachel Dolezal, we should have been listening to African American people, and we should have been listening to people who are of the Cherokee Nation on both of these standards, because this is their narrative, not ours, and it is not Rachel Dolezal's narrative, and it is not Elizabeth Warren's narrative. And I think that's that's the problem, is they are trying to co-opt a narrative about race that is not theirs to tell. It is not their story to tell. And that's why I feel, yes, I do feel Dalzell should have lost her job NAACP, definitely. Whether she, because you could have a white lecturer teaching African-American studies, you could have a Japanese or a Chinese person or an Indian person teaching these. If they are educated and they are respected in their field, there's no reason that race should dictate what you're teaching necessarily, if you know what you're talking.
Someone said that I need to debate Vosh. Is that how you say Vosh? I don't know. I've heard of him. Someone needs to tell me why.
I don't know who Vosh is.
He's a YouTuber. Someone has given us $2. Thank you very much. Let's see. Are there any other questions here? But I guess we're not quite done with the Warren thing. I agree with you that the stories belong to the communities in which they arose. Although, in the case, it's kind of complicated because we said it just a moment ago that the story of race was really imposed upon a group of people, and now it's, I think, their struggle, the liberation struggle, to change that narrative and use that narrative for their own emancipation. But I don't think that that's the only way that people of color will be able to emancipate themselves. But I do think that's an important part of it. Mm-hmm. And I agree that I'm not in any position to decide who is a person of color or not.
Exactly. But despite the fact that
I am.
You are. Yeah. Sure. I forgot. But it is, I think it's a very, it sort of sums up every, that's why I use it in the introduction, is it like this, because it's about perception, right? And that's essentially what I'm talking about as narrative. Is narrative is how we tell the story of our perception, how we perceive the world.
Shane has a good question for us here. I think we may be sunk.
Oh no.
So women can object to men claiming to be women because it's not their narrative?
I think, but then
you're on your own. I'm getting out of here. You go ahead.
I think
figure this one out.
So, I mean, yes, men can object. Doesn't mean they're right, but so you can object, and many men do. But but again, extrapolate further. So drag this out. What the narrative of gender itself, and this is what most trans people discuss, is that it is a narrative. Gender is not, there is sex and there is gender. And I think you can argue there is that narrative tension. And I don't really ever think that'll go away. But the story of men or women as the narrative is dictated to us as the story of men or women. And that's the point. And this is exactly what we're saying about Dalzell and Warren, is that these are narratives that are imposed upon a people, whether it's men or women or African-Americans or the Cherokee Nation. We have imposed narratives of, you know, the Trail of Tears or slavery or historical gender subjugation and pay differences and all these sorts of things. So that is part of the narrative, as much as saying, well, you can't be a woman because you've got a penis or you weren't born a woman or whatever else. But so these are different elements to one broader narrative. And a man can object to a woman identifying, and yes, they can object, but I think it's more interesting for us to hear their narrative. And I think that's vaguely, I think that's more important, frankly.
So I'm supposed to debate Vosh on whether or not to vote for Joe Biden, I guess, and prove that the Democrats are the greatest enemy of humanity, or at least of the left.
I don't know who Vosh is. I'm sorry. I feel woefully ignorant on this.
So let's see. So... someone says, Doug knows this is a forbidden narrative. The question was on women objecting to men claiming to be women. Here's what I think. I think that there are different. I've come up with a clever way out. Let's see if this will work. I think the history of narratives matter, and that the kinds of narratives that there are around the identity of being a woman are not the same as the kinds of narratives there are around race, and that and that the narrative around being a woman has to do with your sexuality and your expression, and the true reason to accept someone who decides that they're the different gender than they were born as is because you want to be, that there's a reason why the trans is in the LGBTQ lineup. Mm-hmm. And it's because this is based on their sexuality and their gender, which you can't really completely split apart. This is an expression of their individuality and of themselves. It's so mm-hmm. you want to be accepting of non-normative orientations.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know I'm probably in deep water already by tying it to sexuality at all, but I'm not saying it's only that, but I'm just saying that this comes from a deep-seated personal need and just as deep-seated as my need to, you know, be a straight guy. I can't get away from it. Mm-hmm. So I hope that people will accept my identity, and I would hope that I could accept someone's Ooh. Identity as a straight woman or a gay woman or what have you, because it's an expression of this inner thing. It's not a cultural category. It's not a communal category the same right. way.
No,
that would be my answer. Now, I don't know. Someone ripped me apart.
And I think that's the thing is, it's not, I think it's the difference between individual narratives and collective narratives. And this is what this is again, going back to Dolezal and Warren, their individual narratives were in conflict with a greater narrative. And it's not for us to tell the stories of these people. And it wasn't the right of Dolezal to tell the story necessarily, but equally, like I said, I don't know whether that would prohibited her from teaching about it and so on and so forth. And that should have been analyzed more. And I think that I mentioned this in the book as well, is that like we are living through a time when foundational narratives, like narratives we believe to be utterly immutable, are coming apart at the seams because of, well, for various different reasons, economic reasons, globalization, millions of reasons. But these, we have reached a point, and amazingly exacerbated by this, but the narratives are being challenged, and I think we should be listening to those individual narratives. And so, yes, I think women can challenge men about whether they identify as women, but equally, then they should be allowed to challenge those people about why they do identify as
women. Well, you know what? They're allowed to, and they're doing it. What makes Trump different from a 90s Democrat? What makes Obama different from Bush? And I think this is aimed at me.
Right. Okay.
So the same person that told me I needed to debate Vosh. So what makes Trump different from a 90s Democrat? Well, I would say that a 90s Democrat would have had a different stance towards immigration than Trump. that a 90s Democrat wouldn't have been that different from a 80s Republican on immigration, that they would both want strong borders, but a pathway to citizenship or integration for those who were already in the country. And Trump has less of a pathway to citizenship. He's more draconian when it comes to people who are in the country already, getting to the Dreamer policy and all of that is part of it. Also, he seemed to be more willing to impose laws and regulations in such a way that they have very inhumane consequences. Not that those inhumane consequences are utterly unique, but the children in cages was different than even Obama's children in cages, because it was a kind of more willed result than what happened with Obama. That said, and then Obama from Bush, I don't think there's nearly as much of a difference between Bush and Obama as there should have been. but I do think Trump is a little different than a 90s Democrat. I think the main thing that makes him different is maybe that he's an amateur, not a professional politician. So So anyway, so let's see if we got any other questions here. We may be wrapping this up in just a minute.
Okay.
Someone else says a 90s Democrat would recommend injecting, wouldn't recommend, I think, they say, injecting bleach to cure a virus.
Most people wouldn't.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that that's probably true. It depends. Maybe Bill Clinton would have suggested that after a couple of drinks or with, you know, with Yeltsin or something like that. Who knows what they would have done. Someone says, look up the debate between Bush Senior and Reagan on immigration and prepare to have your jaw drop. Okay, will do. Listen, I think this has been a lot of fun. People should pick up your book. It's available now. Don't buy it on Amazon. Go to Powell's.com or Waterstones.
The Hive.
The Hive. I used to feel like there was no such thing as ethical consumption under capitalism. Therefore, I would, you know, use Amazon, but they're on strike
right now. Yeah, fuck them.
So we will not be supporting them. Thanks for everybody for watching. Leo, stick around for just a moment after the credits, and we'll see you next week for everybody else.
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
we still, to a large extent, live in the interregnum.